Sinead, I've got to plunge right in with you, actually, and talk about when I first really saw you on stage outside of Ireland in the early 80s. It was at a season at the Royal Shakespeare Company, as Tony mentioned, and you were playing Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing. You were also playing Katerina in The Tournament of the Shrew. Two questions to ask you. One, you may not want to answer or not, but here you are at the very heart of English theatre. It's the early 80s. You're unquestionably an Irish woman. Not an easy time to be Irish in England.
No.
And there you are, as I say, playing the lead roles in these. Mm. What was it like to be there at that time?
Well, professionally it was grand because, you know, our constituency of actors, directors and writers, you know, we sort of transcend those sort of political issues. But socially it was difficult. Mm. I mean, you know,
you're in the heart of middle England there.
I was married to an Englishman, and you couldn't discuss certain aspects of Irish politics. You simply could not discuss them. So that was awkward. So I always felt an outsider over there, and have remained an outsider throughout. And in fact, that outsider status has been very useful for me because it's possibly made me a little bit more objective and forensic when studying English work. But to get in there, to actually even be auditioned by the Royal Shakespeare Company was incredibly difficult for me, and I had the door slammed in my faces on a regular basis until I finally managed to overcome their prejudices because I was Irish and because I was blonde and blue-eyed, and you know, I had no weight, I had no gravitas, and it took ages and ages to persuade them that I had anything to give at all. Mm. So it was a hard old battle as far as Shakespeare was concerned, and I was a really bad Shakespearean actress. No, seriously, I had done one of the worst Desdemonas and probably the worst Juliet outside the Royal Shakespeare Company. And when I was playing Juliet, which was my first big Shakespearean role, I believed that you had to stand and deliver Shakespeare. That's what I thought was required. That you and you never smiled or laughed. God forfend that you should laugh. So I treated him with the respect that he should never be shown as a playwright, ever. Because he's human, he's so human that you can do anything with him. And you will find every aspect of human nature reflected in a Shakespearean play. And so my approach to Shakespeare was completely off the wall when I started. And it took me years. And I had an epiphany when I did a television version of Twelfth Night. There was a time when the BBC had the money and the resources to do the entire Shakespeare canon. And I did Twelfth Night and I was playing Olivia. And I was in the middle of a rehearsal with Felicity Kendall, of all people, who was playing Viola. And I was in the middle of a rehearsal in Acton, East Acton, where we used to rehearse. And I was in the middle of a scene, and I suddenly heard myself speaking, this person speaking, not Olivia, but the symbiosis of me and Olivia together had become real. And I was talking, not delivering anything, but talking. And it was as if the scales fell from my eyes. It was a real epiphany. And from that moment on, I revered Shakespeare, because you can do anything with Shakespeare, absolutely anything.
Well, I think, I mean, when I did see you in that early 80s in Stratford, I was immensely proud of you, because you're an Irish woman doing these parts. But as you say, with Shakespeare, you do get these moments of connection. And I think what you absolutely gave me as an actress there, in terms of my own access to Shakespeare, was your instinctive and deeply intelligent knowledge that he is incomparably the best at understanding human loneliness, at understanding isolation, at absolutely understanding the varieties of human isolation. Yeah. And the two parts that I saw you play, Beatrice and Katerina, they are wonderful comic roles with this closeness to tragedy about them. Mm. But there are two women who are so profoundly alone.
Alone. there.
And you got that magnificently well. You absolutely communicated that. You made that the essence of the poetry. But what I found brilliant about it, what I really thought your Irish to come out, is you made them so bloody funny.
Did I?
So funny. And I just realised then that, you know, as you say, that he has this capacity to turn everything on its head, and what could be tragic, he actually makes it magnificently funny. Do you think that your own Irishness, or is it your own instinctive ability to find some kind of hope in situations, which, pretty black, that brought that edge to the play in there?
Well, it's very interesting. Nobody has ever asked me that question before, but it is a very interesting, because I do believe that there is a sensibility, an Irish sensibility, that is quite different from an English one. And you see it particularly in Chekhov, when Chekhov is played by the Irish and by the English. It's a very, very different experience. And it seems as if we Irish can accommodate in almost the same breath laughter and tears, that we can do that almost turning on a sixpence. And I felt that both those two women were one coin on face of tragedy was on one side and the face of comedy was on the other. And you're absolutely right, I approached both parts from the outsider angle. And I was helped by that with my Irishness. But I think, yes, if there is one thing that we have which is different from a lot of English actors that I've worked with, it's the ability to contain those two very, very, very diverse elements within the same character. And it's fantastic. I mean, you'll probably go to Juno another time, but playing O'Casey, as I'm doing at the moment, playing Juno and the Peacock, O'Casey is one of those extraordinary risk-taking playwrights who will do just that. As Shakespeare is the other, Chekhov is another, who will allow the actor to turn on the sixpence and deliver both. But Shakespeare, for me, there is nothing you can't mine in a Shakespeare play. I played Beatrice for 3 years. I say I grew old in the service of Beatrice. And I carried her through a year at Stratford, a year in London, and then Paris, Vienna, Prague, Madrid, Washington, Los Angeles, and 9 months on Broadway with one character, Beatrice. I never grew tired of her. But the extraordinary thing about it was how she changed in the course of playing these various different countries. Because people who aren't actors, and all of you here know about the theatre, so you'll understand this, but what an audience provides for the actor and for the production is another very strong and concrete element. Can't deny it, it's there. And when you go from country to country, that element becomes even more defined and more focused, and it feeds into your production and it feeds into your playing. By the time I got to New York with Beatrice, I was so strong, you know.
Well, you lifted Derek Jacobi at the end. I remember that. In the dance, she hoisted Jacobi up
in
the air.
I did.
But, I mean, I know from the way you're talking, actually, the immense care you bring to your roles. And I do remember once talking about you to a very knowledgeable connoisseur of acting. And he pointed out a quality about you, which was generosity on stage. And he said the only other actress that he'd ever seen who had that spirit was Peggy Ashcroft. I'm just going to talk to you now about where I think that generosity can be employed to extraordinary dark ends, and that is in your understanding of the Lady Macbeth. Yeah. In the book Clamorous Voices, you have a brilliant insight into her reaction to the line, apparently throwaway line, goes Fleance with you, or he brings Fleance with him. And you say at that instant, you understand he's going to kill a child. He's going to kill a child. Now, you're playing a woman who has said that she would dash out the brains of a child. And in that wonderful, wonderful realisation, you suddenly see what is the tragedy of this woman. Her love for this man is so generous, and it is received with such harshness. Ultimately, he rejects it. You got the pain of that so brilliantly, but you also got the passion of the woman. Do you need to have this deep, passionate involvement to get to the soul of a character, do you think, well, in any part, but particularly in Shakespeare? Mm.
You do. You do. I mean, I, the way I prepare for any Shakespeare that I take on is I do one practical thing, which is I find a discipline of some description for every Shakespeare character I play. And it can be as mad as, for Kate, I pumped iron for 3 months before I started Kate. Just felt right. For Cleopatra, I did a thing called Pilates, which us girls know all about, core strength, because I performed a few gymnastic things, feats, as Cleo. But it seemed the right physical discipline. For Beatrice, I learned to do ballet, oddly enough. For Juno, I lost 2 stone. That was my physical preparation for her. That so that's a physical thing. Then, as far as the actual women, I'm always searching for, and I suppose it's a very simplistic and cliche thing to say, but I'm always searching for the damage done. Because it seems to me you can't understand the saints or the sinners without having some knowledge of where the damage was inflicted and how they either transcend or how that has defined them as human beings. So I read a great deal. I think a great... Oh, I read the play over and over and over again. I don't learn unless I really, really have to, like Our Lady of Sligo or Brian Freer's Faith Healer, where you have to learn before. But I don't like learning in that way because the organic process of rehearsal is fantastically productive if you're all starting at the same stage, so to speak. But really, that I suppose if I have a method, I have a... just one practical physical thing that I bring to every role I study. And then I read as much, and I read the play over and over again for insights. But you see, you know, it's, for instance, when I was playing Cleopatra, I hadn't a clue how to approach Cleopatra. I was so intimidated by the notion, by the iconography of Cleopatra. You know, it's been written about, films made, books, poems, everything. There isn't, you know, the version of her that is presented to the world is insane and bears no relation to the woman who existed. She was an incredibly intelligent woman. She was rather ugly and she spoke 11 languages and, you know, she did extraordinary things for the country. You don't see any of that because the spin doctors over in Rome were busy, you know, distorting the image. She was this terrible woman that seduced and whatever. So I did lots of reading, but even so, I was completely intimidated by the idea of playing this woman. And then, so I read and read and read, no help anywhere to be got. And then I went back to the play, always go back to the play, always go back to the woman, always go back to the human being and find where the damage is. And I found it in the first line. In Cleopatra's very first line, I'll probably misquote this line, so anyone can correct me, or you can go and research it afterwards, but I think that Cleopatra's first line to Antony in the play Antony and Cleopatra is, "If this be love indeed, tell me how much." Now that's the cry of every insecure woman. It is the cry of the mistress over the wife. If this be love indeed, tell me how much. And I suddenly found she's a mistress. She's not a wife. She's losing her hold. She's getting old. She's losing him, you know. So with the Scottish play, which I find difficult to even saying in a lecture theatre, because it's superstitious to say it, and you have to do all sorts of shenanigans in order to counteract that thing. But, you know, with Lady M, I was breastfeeding my youngest child. And in it, she says, I would pull him from my breast and dash his brains out rather than that you should fail in this endeavour to kill the king. And there, she says, I have given suck, mm-hmm. which means she had a child. Mm-hmm. And they either lost the child mm-hmm. or Who knows? Shakespeare doesn't explain it or elaborate. So I was in a position as a woman, as an actress, I was actually nursing my kid, my baby at the time, and I was rehearsing Lady M. So I was able to bring to bear on that particular production and that particular character at the time all the feelings that I was experiencing with my child, and the understanding that to tear your child's mouth from your breast and bash his brains out was beyond comprehension in terms of what you're prepared to do, what extremes you're prepared to go to. So it follows that how she felt about him was the most all-consuming, all-enveloping, every moral and, every received morality or received modes of behaviour thrown out the window. And I will do what has to be done. We used to, Jonathan Pryce was playing him, and we used to imagine what they would lie in bed talking about. Mm. And it was always about, you deserve this. Mm. You deserve this.
Hunger.
Yeah, and it was a hunger for power, for him, not for her. And that's as Frank says, when he, casts her off, so to speak, it's the betrayal of everything that she's built her life on. So.
Just to go back to that quote that you had there about the damage done, that you investigate the damage done. When we were working on Three Sisters, I, of course, noticed the meticulousness of your preparation for rehearsal in rehearsal. It's an extraordinarily different meticulousness from what Sarah Cusack does and what Niamh Cusack does and what Cyril Cusack does. So the big revelation about work on that production was there is no Cusack formula. They go their own way. But I do remember in a rehearsal, out of the blue, when it's just the three of you there, it's in the third act, it's during the fire, and you came up with a movement, almost like a dance movement, when Masha confesses her love for Vyshinin. Mm. And you had this strange movement. And then you, in the play, you quote, I'd be like the madman in Gogol and say nothing, 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 again, not be it. But you did this silence, and the others let you have this silence at the end, where it was almost as if you were anticipating the future. And a shudder went through the place. This is what Masha, the most damaged, the middle daughter, the middle one is always the one, beware of. She's the most damaged. And you got that with such extraordinary fidelity to the whole play, as you say. Did you find Masha a tough nut to crack? Or did she come with some raven instinct to you?
I think Masha was in my blood. I don't know why. I had no right to play her for a star because I wasn't the middle sister. I was the eldest sister. My sister Sarcha was the middle sister. And but in the end, Adrian Noble, who was our director, chose to cast us in that way. So Sarcha played Olga, the oldest sister, and I, the actual eldest sister, played Masha. But there was about Masha that craving, that yearning for another world, another horizon to explore was something that I recognised and and always falling in love with unsuitable men, which was what I was always getting up to. But it was that sort of, I think that desperation to get away from the claustrophobia of that existence and her understanding that it was claustrophobic and that she had to break out of it. And she sees Vyshinin as a way of getting out of it, not relying on herself, but relying on an outside and such a hopeless one to rely on. You know, it's pathetic. But I understood that completely.
Well, she's a woman of such extraordinary imagination, Masha. And she has an infinite capacity to invent her existence.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, and you absolutely know how to do that.
Yeah.
You know how to give a character that interior life, that imaginative life, whereby lines suddenly have a lifetime contained in a sentence. And you absolutely can communicate that. That's a great, great... That's the great essence of your art, I think, actually.
Really?
And I mean, it's why you can play the Chekhovs, why you can play the Shakespeares, and why, as you say, there's an infinity of response to them. And you tune into that infinity. It's a great, great truth to possess.
I don't know. You know, I had to do an interview this morning on the telephone to a newspaper about parts that I wanted or for parts that I found challenging or something. And at the end, I said to the interviewer, I said, please don't make me sound like a wanker. Because there is, you know, there's actors talking about their art always makes me feel a little bit queasy because I don't think of it in that terms. I know when I go and see a great performance or I see a great production, which just opens up a shutter on not just the play, but on life, where you go out into the world with a new knowledge, is extraordinary and wonderful. And I suppose you can say that is art. But what I do, you know, it's what children do. We dress up and we imagine. And all right, maybe I do have an imaginative, the capacity to imagine lives that are not my own. Because I do think it's I do think what is interesting about what an actor brings to a play or a character, obviously I have to bring my own history, because it must be in there somewhere. So at some point, what I describe as symbiosis occurs, where the two, you know, the two sort of join together, and what is produced is a cross between the two, and it's, one hopes, is a truthful rendition of what the playwright intended.
Mm. Well, I can talk about your art. You can't, or I beat the crap out of you. You know that. I'm very glad you've made that correction. Yeah. But there's no doubt about, in your art,
yes,
you
art.
Have true capacity for understanding what we might call poets in the theatre try to do. Yeah. You do it with Chekhov, and you do it with Shakespeare, and you are so close in your intimacy with Irish writing, particularly this particular type of Irish writing. You know about the hardness of the poetry in Irish writing.
Yeah.
You've known about it in O'Casey now and the Abbey. You know about it with Friel in the...
And you. And you.
And well, please, we won't mention me in the same name as that fellow.
I will. You know, I will. I'm allowed.
You do it in Faith Healy. You, of course, do it with Sebastian's play, Our Lady of Sligo.
Yeah.
You did it as well, I think, in Aristocrats. You got something about Alice in Aristocrats.
Did I?
That you suddenly found what was wrong with this woman was that, for God's sake,
I
will you go and write?
I wonder why I always go for what's wrong. It's because I love the sinners. I'm not all that keen on the saints. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you do a play like Our Lady of Sligo, you're starting from scratch, really.
Oh, shit.
You're the only one who's ever done it. And you're dealing with, I mean, with the best world in the world. Sebastian's language is demanding, and if he was here, I would use another word to his face.
Well, I'd love to talk to you about that just for a few minutes.
I'd say demanding. You know?
I'd love to talk to you about that, because it was the most extraordinary experience of my life. When I read Our Lady of Sligo, I don't know if any of you have seen it, probably not, but it consists, the play, of a woman lying in a hospital bed dying of cancer. And she lies there all night long, right? So this is what I read, and she never stops talking. Never. And she's a monster. She's a monster. And there are characters who wind themselves around her, either in the present day, i.e. the nurse in the hospital and those who come to visit her daughter, and those from the past, the shadows from the past. And they weave in and out of her life. And in her past incarnations, she's allowed to get out of the bed and dance and do a few things like that. But mainly, she's in the bed, non-stop, talking and dying. So when I read the play, I thought, it can't be done. It can't be. It's impossible to do a play like this. One, for an actor to learn the lines. Two, to make any theatrical sense. It'll make no theatrical sense. It has nothing to offer theatrically. Lyrically, it's gorgeous. But, you know, nothing to offer theatrically. And I went and met Sebastian Barry and Max Stafford Clark, who's a legend of a director. Read anything he's ever written, those of you who are interested in theatre studies. Anything that he's ever written about the theatre, because he is a past master. And I couldn't have done it without him, because he's forensic. and he has a particular method which he brought to bear on this play. If you want to hear about it, I'll tell you another time. But anyway, he used that method. But it was incredibly hard. And after about 2 weeks of rehearsal, Sebastian was there every day with his... He's the most beautiful-looking man. Do you know what Sebastian looks like? Gorgeous-looking man. And he'd be sitting there behind the table with Max and a couple of stage, and his face would all blush as he watched me. Now, I was playing his granny, so I suppose he had every right to look like Rob, because his granny was a monster and I was probably playing her badly. But anyway... after about 2 weeks, he took me out to lunch, and I said, listen, Sebastian, I can't do this. I can't do it. It's an impossible play, and it can't be done. And he said the immortal line, Sinead, my play will give you grace.
I'm going to try that.
You must try it, Frank. I mean, it was just mind-blowing.
He gets away with it. I would be slaughtered.
Yeah, with those Byronic locks, you know. He said, my play will give you grace. And it did. And he was absolutely correct. And I got more out of playing that than probably anything I've ever done in my life, because it was such a challenge. But, you know, the view, when I climbed the mountain, the view from the top was magnificent. But again, I had to go... She was an onion, a huge, big Spanish onion. And I had to peel her away like that and that and that until I got to this little sliver in the middle, which was heartbreaking, which was her, where she began, where all the damage started. And that was an amazing...
She's a very terrified woman, isn't she, underneath it all? And another very terrified woman is Grace in Faith Healer.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that a wee bit.
With Grace. Well, of course, I came in there at a slight disadvantage. There was Donal McCann, the legendary Donal McCann. Did any of you see Donal on stage? Yeah. Tony did up there. Well, he was one of the great Irish actors of all time. And he had already played Frank 10 years before. And, you know, again, a sort of iconic production of Faith Healer. And Ron Cook, who was playing Teddy. So they'd both done it 10 years before. And I came in, so, you know, I was frightened by the notion. And it's 45 minutes. It's 45-minute monologue. That's not easy to do. It really isn't easy to learn, and it's not easy to do. But also, you know, what she puts herself through as she goes, as she relates their history. The baby, the birth of the baby, which is just searing in its horror, and her relationship with Frank, the faith healer. You know, you had to examine very, very dark bits of yourself, and that's what the actor has to do over and over again. It probably makes us extremely shallow people, because we're forever delving into the damage that we've understood and the damage that we have sustained in our lives, and you use it again and again. And I had to use a lot of stuff in Faith Healer. I only once lost the lines during, and it was very interesting. I hate knowing who's out front, because one level of my concentration goes if I know that there's somebody out front. It doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't have to be anyone loved or important. It doesn't matter who it is. It can be a child of five. But I will start seeing the play through the child of five's eyes. And so one little level of my concentration is gone. So I don't like knowing. But I was playing Faith Healer at the Royal Court. And there was one of those big glittery fundraising occasions. And they had everybody. And so we got a list as long as your arm of the famous people who are going to be out there. Presidents of this country and that country. Mary Robinson was there. Various other people. And loads of actors and writers and that. Directors and people. Anyway, they were all there. So I thought, I'd faced the list and I thought, ah, to hell with it, I'll cope, you know, and I put it out of my head. But as I was going down to walk on stage, the stage doorkeeper at the Royal Court, remember him, Luke, said to me, do you know who's in? I said, Luke, I know who's in. I know who's in. You can't frighten me anymore. He said, no, you don't know who's in. I said, Frank, I know exactly who. I got the list. He said, no, these were latecomers. I said, Luke, don't tell... He said, Harold Pinter. And his wife, Antonia. Now, Harold was going through a writer's crisis. of not being able to write plays. He had become so politically aware that his nerve endings were being so shaken by what was going on in Nicaragua. I can't remember it was Nicaragua, I think. And he was so shaken by all that he couldn't write. He couldn't write plays. He wrote poetry, but he couldn't write plays. And he was going through all that. And I'd known Harold all my adult life, sort of vaguely. And the character of Frank in Faith Healer, because it's a metaphor, really, for the writer, isn't it? Couldn't you say?
Absolutely.
It's a bit simplistic to say that, but it is a bit of a metaphor. And the man can't perform the miracles anymore, or did he? Was he ever able to perform the miracles? Anyway, so out I go on the stage. 45 minutes I've got to deliver. And I'm standing in the middle of the Royal Court stage, and Max Stafford Clark, who was right at the back, because he was the artistic director at the time, right at the back, he said what he felt from me on the stage was an electric current that went from me to a single person in the audience. And he thought, her husband's in, or somebody important is in, you know. He had no idea, but he said it was absolutely palpable that there was something going, shooting from me to that person. And I dried stone dead, and there was nothing I could do. I couldn't find a line. I couldn't remember what the play was. I couldn't remember. All I was conscious of was standing on that stage and not being able to speak. And I put my head in my hands like that, and I think I couldn't hear the prompt. Prompt came. Couldn't take it. And finally, I put my head in my hands for about a minute, I think. And then I found somewhere in the play about 20 lines later or 30 lines later. And I was able to continue. But, I mean, that's what I'm talking about, the sort of mystery of theatre and understanding why something like that can happen to you. Out of nowhere, just because there is something in the play about what that man was suffering. And so so that's what playwriting sort of is about for me. It's finding all those.
Well, you have this, as I say, infinite capacity to marry yourself to the text. And in so many of the roles that you've played, you've examined partnerships and you've kept them so brilliantly confined to the play. Do you know what I mean? It's not comments and other things. You're now playing savage, destructive, magnificent, strange Juno, the goddess, married to the captain. And you really do feel there is a marriage happening in this play, but you're also feeling there is a marriage ending. And I think you locate the tragedy of the play in that loss.
Ah, great.
And it really is an astonishing reading of it. I've never seen anybody do that before.
Well, I know.
She's a married woman, you know?
Yeah.
Her tragedy, she's a married woman.
It's interesting, you see. When I come to study a play, I have to throw away the shadows. You know, there were so many bloody Junos. But actually, the play has been produced in the Abbey 45 times. Guess how many Junos there have been in 45 productions of Juno and the Peacock? Guess. Anyone? Seven. So, you know, when an actress got a hold of Juno, she held on to her like that. And she would play her over and over and over again. So all these people were in the wings pointing at me, saying, do it this way, do it this way, do it this way. And I didn't care. All I cared about was Juno. And I cared about her passionately. I mean, more passionately, I think, than anybody else I've ever played. Because those women were amazing, those tenement women. They were extraordinary. That courage in the face of just unbelievable adversity. And I wanted to find her. But most of all, I wanted to find an ordinary woman. And I think that if you say there's any art about what I do, I want to find the ordinary. Because the extraordinary only happens because it's out of the ordinary. But you've got to find the ordinary first. You've got to find what is. And for me, Juno was an ordinary Dublin woman facing conditions on a daily basis that hundreds and hundreds and thousands of Dublin women were facing in those squalid, awful tenements where maybe as many as 80 to 100 people would live in one house that had housed one family in before 1800. So I wanted to find her. And, you know, people say, Juno, yes, the beautiful Juno-esque. Juno-esque. The reason she's called Juno is because she and Jack met in June, married in June, and she was born in June, and Johnny was born in June. And that's why she's called Juno. There's nothing to do with Homer or any goddess-like quality. She's got none of those. She is an ordinary woman to her bootstraps. She's working. And I gave her a backstory, because, OK, she doesn't give her a backstory. My backstory is... You want to hear it? Well, I had to find... Because it has to be practical, you see. And it turns out in the play, or the only clues he gives, is that she goes to work and that she is able to be a bit late for work. She cooks some sausages, which makes her late. So I thought, can't be a factory. Domestic service might be a bit difficult if you've got tough employers. So I put her... There used to be a public toilet in the middle of O'Connell Street. You're all far too young to remember it, but I remember. She was just opposite the Gresham. It was right in the middle there. And there was always a little lady who sat in a pinny in the public toilets, and she would clean the toilets and she'd clean the floor. And I thought, that's where Juno works. Down the road from Manchester Square, down the road from Henrietta Street, wherever I wanted to place her. And that's where she works. And she's got a pal. They do shift work. So if she's late, her pal will do it. Because that's the sort of stuff you have to give yourself in your brain. Otherwise, characters don't make sense. So if the playwright doesn't provide you with all this information, then you provide the information. So I gave her that backstory. But most of all, I just wanted her to be ordinary. And then the public events that happened in 1922 in our country, you know, what was going on, the high politics of 22, what was being carried on in the Doyle and Mansion House and Leinster House and all those things, and how it was impacting on this little ordinary woman, losing a son, unemployment, deprivation, no money, no future, repossession, you know, all those things that we're all going to face.
Sinead has to live very shortly, unfortunately, but that's one of the business of theatre. If you've got notes of some of it, I think we have time for maybe one or
a few
two
questions, please.
Yeah. Anybody want to take it? Owen.
What do you look for in a director?
Oh, it's a really interesting question. Owen has just asked me what I'd look for in a director. You know, I have some big favourites. But I suppose what I want from a director is that they can understand or begin to see what my little journey, the journey I'm taking. And if I'm taking the wrong side roads, cul-de-sacs, that they should shift me away from the cool. But most of all, what I require from them is a good memory, because what they can remind me of is something that I did a week before, which actually fed into something that maybe I found a week later. And he'll say, when you did that, do you remember when you said it and that character reacted in that way? But like Max Stafford Clarke was... You know, he has a process which I hope some of you one day... There's a great book called Letters to George, which Max wrote about... Have you read that, Frank?
I have.
Yeah, George Farquhar. But it talks about the process that he uses as a director, and it's very unique and very idiosyncratic. And I thought I'd never be able to use his method, that it was far too clinical, but it was completely brilliant for Sebastian's lyrical outpourings because he was forensic. But then in other plays, what you want is, somebody who can produce an atmosphere in the rehearsal room where actors can make tits of themselves, you know, who can lose all inhibition and make idiots of yourself, because you have to do that as well. There can't be any inhibition in there. You have to. So, I don't know, you're looking for different things for different plays, maybe. But I've worked with some great ones, and they have a huge contribution to make. Are you a director?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's about text, really. Yeah. It's always about text. Understanding of text. Some directors, like Howard, got us up on day one. Got us up on our feet on day one. We didn't sit around and do all the, you know, what does my character believe and think and what's her backstory? Not at all. Up. Max Stafford Clarke would sit for a week, doing actioning, it's called. I won't tell you what it is, but Jesus. Trevor Nunn just talks, you know.
Get away.
Yeah. Mm. but they all provide something. So there's no, what's the word, Frank? You're the writer.
Formula.
There's no formula for director.
I have my uses. Thanks, Sean. Any others? Come in.
Enter. Your portrayal of Desdemona and Juliet and how you weren't happy with them. When you get a role that you feel you haven't nailed, or one you let slip by, or when you felt you didn't really do justice, how do you deal with that? Or how do you carry when you go and do another role?
Oh, it's really hard, you know. It's really hard. Kierkegaard, now very few of you will know this, maybe even Frank doesn't know, maybe even Tony doesn't know this. Kierkegaard wrote a book called Crisis in the Life of an Actress. And it was about a Juliet who played Juliet when she was 17. And she was hailed by the critics as, you know, absolutely getting every aspect of Juliet because of her youth and her vitality and her poetry. And Kierkegaard thought she was bollocks. She then played it when she was, I don't know, 43, 45. And he saw it again. And she was magnificent. And she had understood every level of Juliet. She was far too old to play it. Didn't matter. She'd understood what a 17-year-old could never understand. She might have brought... So I know I'll never get to play Juliet, but I'd make a cracking Juliet now. But it's really sad. It's really sad when they go by. And like when I played Cleopatra, we had a bit of a problem in the Antony and Cleo. I won't go into what it was, but it was a bit of a problem. And I would love to play her again. Yes, I'd love.
Okay.
What do you look for in new writing?
It's always, for me, it's always the journey. I mean, you know, you can see from the parts that I talk about all the time. You know, Mash is a prime example. You know, of somebody who is journeying from one place and the incidents that occur on the way and where the journey takes her. And it's always that. I'm never interested in... And I suppose I do see, but hearing myself talk today makes me aware that the ones that I'm really interested in are the ones that are damaged. And finding out when the damage occurred, how the damage occurred, and what steps she took to cover over the damage. And what it did. Because for me, you know, I look at my life back, I'm 63 now, and I look back on my life. And I think if I hadn't done that, if that incident had not occurred in my life, I would not be the woman I am now. I would not be saying the things I'm saying here, doing the things I'm doing on the stage, if that decision hadn't been taken. So that's what I love about my work acting, is actually finding out what made them commit the crime or what made them become the woman they become. I'm not interested in anything else, really. And the rehearsal process for me is... the discovery process is, for me, what I love most about my job. And the discovery process, if you're lucky and you're working with a great playwright, you can carry on that discovery process for years in one character. I said I could have lived in that version of Three Sisters. I could have lived there happily for years, finding out about her.
Mm.
So that's what I love. Yeah, but we all know we are, don't we? I mean, we can just look back and we can pick out those moments. And then we paint over the cracks. But for the actor and the director, what you have to do is find out what those cracks were before you paint it over. And that's what you do every time you look at a play, or every time you look at a character, to my mind anyway. And that's great fun. And then you always find the child and remember what they looked like. Even Hitler. He was one once. Or Gaddafi. Look at that.
Okay, one more.
Do you have heroines? And who are they? Perhaps there are too many.
No, I once had to do that little. I was once set that task. I have to say, to my absolute shame, I came up with 5 men. It makes me blush now. It was about 25 years ago, and I was asked to do it on the back of the Oldie. It can't have been all that long ago then. Maybe 15 years ago, and there were mainly men. But, you know, Peggy Ashcroft. I don't know, Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, there are loads. You look at them all over the place and you'll find them. But it's ordinary women that I'm interested in. You know, there are the greats like Ashcroft or Aung San Suu Kyi. But what I find over and over, the people who move me, like Juno moves me, are not those who somehow have come to prominence. I'm sure there's a reason why all these people come to prominence. I mean, you know, they're great, probably. But I found more moving than anything else is finding heroism in the ordinary and in the ordinary people. I don't know, that just gets me. I choke up when I think about it, when I talk about it. And that's, I suppose, why I love what I do. And I'm not interested in any other aspect of my business. In fact, I find it slightly shameful. I do. I think the money we're paid is shameful, not in the Abbey Theatre, but certainly not in the Abbey Theatre. But, you know, there are fees that are paid that are shameful because they're totally disproportionate to what we do. And I find the glitter and hype that surrounds our business shameful. But the actual business of exploring characters and plays, that'll take me till, you know, I drop into the grave, happily. So I can't name you anyone, really. Juno. I love Juno.
Sinead, we can halt it there, but I want to thank you for your kindness and coming and sharing so much with us today, for your good sense, everything that you talked about, and for just the enormous wisdom that you do show. You, as I said, 2 words that are linked with your generosity and grace, and you're the embodiment of both. You proved it today, as always. My magnificent Sinead Cusack, thank you.
Don't you think that Frank has a future in this business? He's someone else.